protest would be sent and the reply would lament the obvious theft. But the rockets were just a diversion. The actual attack was timed pretty well. It was less than 1 hour before the shift ended. As far as we could reconstruct it, the plan was a combination of patience and sudden desperate force. The two rebels who did it had been working for the food service in Portobello for years. They rolled into the lounge adjacent to the locker room to set up the buffet most of us tore into after our shift. But they had scatter guns, two street sweepers taped under the food carts. There was a third person, never caught, who cut the fiber line that gave command its physical picture of the lounge and locker room. That gave them about 30 seconds of "somebody tripped over the cable," while the two pulled out their weapons and walked through the unlocked doors that connect the lounge to the locker room, and the locker room to operations. They stepped into ops and started shooting. The tapes show that they lived for 2.02 seconds after the door opened, during which time they got off 78 20-gauge buckshot blasts. They didn't hurt any of us in the cages, since that would take armor-piercing shells and more, but they killed all 10 of the warm-up mechanics and 2 of the techs, who were behind, supposedly, bulletproof glass. The shoe guard, who dozes over us in his armored suit, woke up at the noise and toasted them. It was actually a close thing, as it turned out, because he took 4 direct hits. They didn't harm him. But if they'd hit the laser, he would have had to lumber down and attack them hand to hand. That might have given them time to crack the shells. They each had 5 shaped charges taped under their shirts. All the weapons were Alliance issue. The fully automatic shotguns fired depleted uranium ammunition. The propaganda machine would play up the suicide aspect of it. Lunatic Pedros who place no value on human life, as if they had just run amok and wiped out 12 young men and women. The reality was frightening, not only because of their success in infiltrating and attacking, but also in the bold and desperate dedication that it bespoke. We hadn't just hired those 2 people off the street. Everyone who worked in the compound had to pass an exhaustive background check and psychological testing that proved they were safe. How many other time bombs were walking around Portobello? Candy and I were lucky, in a grim way, because both our seconds died instantly. Wu didn't even have time to turn around. He heard the door click open, and then a shotgun blast took off the top of his head. Candy's second, Marla, died the same way. Some of them were pretty bad. Rose's second had time to stand up and turn half around, and was shot in the chest and abdomen. She lived long enough to drown in blood. Claude's was shot in the crotch as a reward for facing the enemy. He lived for a long couple of seconds, jackknifed in pain, before a second blast tore out his lower spine and kidneys. It was a light jack, but still profoundly disturbing, especially for those of us whose seconds died in pain. We were all tranked automatically before they popped our cages and rolled us to trauma. I got a glimpse of the carnage all around, the big white machines that were trying to hammer life back into the ones whose brains were intact. The next day we found out that none of those had been successful. Their bodies were too completely shredded. So there was no next shift. Our soldier boys stood in frozen postures in their guard positions, while Shu infantry, suddenly pressed into guard detail, swarmed around them. The natural assumption was that the attack on our seconds would be followed immediately by a ground attack on the base itself, before another platoon of soldier boys could be brought in. Maybe it would have happened if 1 or 2 of the rockets had found their mark. But all was quiet this time, and Fox platoon, from the zone, was in place in less than an hour. They let us out of trauma after a couple of hours, and at first said we weren't to tell anyone what happened. But, of course, the Nagumi weren't going to keep it quiet. Automatic cameras had recorded the carnage, and a copy of the scene fell into Nagumi hands. It was powerful propaganda, in a world that couldn't be shocked by death or violence. To the camera, Julian's 10 comrades were not young men and women, naked under an unrelenting spray of lead. They were symbols of weakness, triumphant evidence of the Alliance's vulnerability in the face of Nagumi dedication. The Alliance called it a freakish kamikaze attack by two murderous fanatics. It was a situation that could never be duplicated. They didn't publicize the fact that all of the native staff in Portobello were fired the next week, replaced by American draftees. This was hard on the economy of Portobello proper, as the base was the largest single source of income. Panama was a most favored nation, but not a full Alliance member, which in practical terms meant it had limited use of American nanoforges. But there weren't any of the machines within its boundaries. There were about 24 small countries in a similar unstable situation. 2 nanoforges in Houston were reserved for Panama. The Panama Import-Export Board decided what they were to be used for. Houston supplied them with a wish book, a list of how long it took to make something, and what raw materials had to be supplied by the canal zone. Houston could supply air and water and dirt. If something required an ounce of platinum or a speck of dysprosium, Panama would have to dig it up somewhere or somehow. The machine had limits. You could give it a bucket of coal and it could return a perfect copy of the Hope Diamond, which would make a dandy paperweight. Of course, if you wanted a fancy gold crown, you'd have to supply the gold. If you wanted an atomic bomb, you'd have to give it a couple of kilograms of plutonium. But fission bombs were not in the wish book, nor were soldier boys or any other products of advanced military technology. Planes and tanks were okay, and among the most popular items. This is the way things worked. The day after the Portobello base was emptied of native workers, the Panama Import-Export Board presented the Alliance with a detailed analysis of the impact of the loss of income. It was obvious that someone had foreseen the eventuality. After a couple of days haggling, the Alliance agreed to increase their nanoforge allotment from 48 hours per day to 54, along with a one-time settlement of $500 million credit in rare materials. So if the Prime Minister wanted a Rolls-Royce with a solid gold chassis, he could have it, but it wouldn't be bulletproof. The Alliance did not officially care how client nations came up with their requests for the machine's largesse. In Panama, there was at least a pretense of democracy. The Import-Export Board being advised by elected representatives, compradores, one from each province and territory, so there were occasional well-publicized imports that benefited only the poor. Like the United States, technically, they had a semi-socialist electro-cash economy. The government supposedly took care of basic needs, the citizens worked for money for luxuries, which were paid for either by electronic credit transfer or cash. But in the United States, luxuries were just that, entertainments or refinements. In the canal zone, they were things like medicine and meat, more often bought with cash than with plastic. There was a lot of resentment of their own government and Tio Rico to the north, which gave rise to an ironic pattern common to most client states. Incidents like the Portobello Massacre ensured that Panama would not have its own nanoforges for a long time. But the unrest that led to the massacre was directly traceable to its lack of the magic box. We got no peace the first week after the massacre. The huge publicity machine that fueled the war boy mania and was usually concerned with more interesting platoons, turned its energies on us. The general media wouldn't leave us alone either. In a culture that lived on news, it was the story of the year. Bases like Portobello were attacked all the time, but this was the first time the mechanic's inner sanctum had been violated. That the mechanics who were killed had not been in charge of the machines was a detail repeatedly stressed by the government and downplayed by the press. They even interviewed some of my UT students to see how I was taking it. And, of course, they were quick to defend me by saying it was business as usual in the classroom, which of course demonstrated how unfeeling I was, or how strong and resilient, or how traumatized, depending on the reporter. Actually, it may have demonstrated all of the above, or maybe just that a particle physics practicum is not a place where you discuss personal feelings. When they tried to bring a camera into my classroom, I called a shoo and had them evicted. It was the first time in my academic career that being a sergeant meant more than being an instructor, however junior. Likewise, I was able to commandeer two shoes to keep the reporters at a distance when I went out. But for almost a week, they did have at least one camera watching me, which kept me away from Amelia. Of course, she could just walk into my apartment building as if she were visiting someone else, but the possibility that someone would make a connection, or happen to see her walking into my own apartment, was too great to risk. There were still some people in Texas who would be unhappy about a white woman who had a black man, 15 years younger, for a lover. There might even be some people in the university who would be unhappy about it. The newsies seemed to have lost interest by Friday, but Amelia and I went to the club separately, and I brought along my shoes to stand guard outside. We overlapped trips to the bathroom and managed a quick embrace unobserved. Otherwise, most of my apparent attention went to Marty and Franklin. Marty confirmed what I had suspected.
The autopsy showed that your seconds, Jack, was disconnected by the same blast that killed him, so there's no reason for it to have felt any different to you than just being unplugged.
At first, I didn't even realize he was gone, I said, not for the first time. The input from the rest of my platoon was so strong and chaotic, the ones whose seconds were hurt, but still alive.
But it wouldn't be as bad for them as being fully jacked to someone who died, Franklin said. Most of you have gone through that.
I don't know. When somebody dies in the cage, it's a heart attack or stroke, not being ripped open by buckshot. A light jack may only feed back, say, 10% of that sensation, but it's a lot of pain. When Carolyn died, I had to clear my throat. With Carolyn, it was just a sudden headache, and she was gone, just like coming unjacked.
I'm sorry, Franklin said, and filled both our glasses.
The wine was a duped Lafitte Rothschild 28, the wine of the century. So far. Thanks. It's years now. I sipped the wine, good but presumably beyond my powers of discrimination. The bad part, a bad part, was that it didn't occur to me that she'd died, nor to anyone else in the platoon. We were just standing on a hill waiting for a snatch. Thought it was a comm failure.
They knew at the company level,
Marty said. Of course they did, and of course they wouldn't tell us, risk our screwing up the snatch. But when we popped, her cage was empty. I found a medic, and she said they'd done a brain scan and there wasn't enough to save. They'd taken her down to autopsy already. Marty, I've told you this more than once before, sorry. Marty shook his head in commiseration.
No closure, no leave-taking.
They should have popped you all once you were in place, Franklin said. They can snatch cold boys as easily as warm ones. Then you would have at least known before they took her away.
I don't know. My memory of the whole thing is cloudy. They knew we were lovers, of course, and had me tranked before I was popped. A lot of the counseling was just drug therapy with conversation, and after a while, I wasn't taking the drugs anymore, and I had Amelia there in place of Carolyn, in some ways. I felt a sudden pang of frustration and longing, partly for Amelia after this stupid week of isolation, partly for the unattainable past. There would never